Thank you, sir. Our memory verse for this week is found in chapter 18. And it is, we see that it's verse 33 of 2 Samuel chapter 18. And it simply says, "The king was shaken, and he went up to a room over the gateway, and he wept. And as he went, he said, 'Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son.'" And of course, this is after Absalom is killed in his rebellion. And we'll actually be looking at that rebellion more Sunday morning. So we'll be in chapter 18 Sunday morning. But tonight I thought we would kind of start in chapter 15, which is where our reading schedule had us this week, the first chapter that we were going to read, and a little bit of setting that scene of that rebellion, and now what has happened in between where we left off last Sunday with David and Bathsheba, and then Nathan confronting David in his sin. In chapter 13 and 14, to get to where we are, we see a number of tragic events in David's life. And I'm going to talk maybe for just a moment Sunday about the fact that we see David's children struggle with sin. And for me, some of that goes back to David's own sin. And, you know, as we talked about the consequences of that sin, and we saw it, and we talked about last time when we were in here about his baby, their baby dying, and then that the start of their marriage with him with Bathsheba, but just the consequences of their sin. We see here the consequence of that sin continuing in the behavior of his children. And what I'm reminded is that it's real easy for us to tell our children what to do, but what they actually grow up doing is they actually grow up doing a lot of what they see us do. And that the real way we teach our children is how we live and the impact that we make. And if you remember, we talk about the Shema a lot in Deuteronomy 6. And, it talks about love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul. And it says impress them on your children. And then it talks about in your laying down and your getting up and your sitting in the way and your walking in the way. That it's our life that really teaches our children how to live. And we can say everything, but then when they see the sinfulness in us, that sometimes they mock that. And I want you to think about David's actions and what that told his children. And part of it was when they saw him not listen to God, not listen to the Holy Spirit, to take this woman who wasn't his wife because he wanted her, even though he knew it was against God's command, and then to try to cover up that sin, even by murdering Uriah, that seeing that just that attitude of taking what I wanted and not listening to God, that then when you see Amon wanting Tamar and raping her, taking what he wanted in spite of the fact that it was wrong and in spite of what the consequences, and then you see Absalom taking revenge and killing Amon, his stepbrother, and so you see again, I think this some of the fruit of that unrighteous seed that David had planted in his sin, and so you know, and we see that with our lives and those around us, and again, that's why and I'll talk about this Sunday. Not that that means that everything Amon did and Absalom did were because of David's sin. But that still that influence on them, and I was talking with someone and talking about one reason I made a decision. Well, I mean, not how long ago it was now? Almost 40 years ago. It was 40 years ago that I would not drink any alcohol anymore after having drunk some as a teenager. That wasn't something I needed to do. But I remember that part of the reason that I gave myself permission to do that as a teenager was because I'd seen one of the deacons from our church buying booze at a K&B drugstore. And I said, well, if it's okay for him to do it, it's okay for me to do it. And the truth is, that's what our sin and our behavior can do. And so that's one reason why I completely abstain from alcohol, is because I think I don't want to mislead anybody else or give them a reason to justify their own problem because they saw me do it. And so that's what you see here, because of David's actions, that it influenced and encouraged in a negative way his children. Well, so that happens, and Absalom flees, but David doesn't really punish Absalom for what he has done. And then Absalom comes back, and David tried to encourage him to come back, but when he comes back, David refuses to see him. And so another thing that we'll talk about Sunday is part of the problem with rebellious children is not only the example we have set, but the problem is that we ignore. We don't discipline when we should. And then the other part of that is we ignore and we let the relationship break off. It's easier for us to ignore the relationship than to do the hard things it's going to take to maintain the relationship. And so that's what we see here. And then we see probably politics in its simplest form that Absalom plays. So let's pick up there, chapter 15, the first verse. As Absalom begins to plot his rebellion against David as king. So verse 1. In the course of time, Absalom provided himself with a chariot and horses and with 50 men to run ahead of him. And he would get up early and he would stand by the side of the road leading to the city gate. And whenever anyone came with a complaint to be placed before the king for a decision, Absalom would call out to him, "What town are you from?" And he would answer, "Your servant is from one of the tribes of Israel." Then Absalom would say to him, "Look, your claims are valid and proper, but there's no representative of the king to hear you." And Absalom would add, "If only I were appointed judge in the land, then everyone who has a complaint or case could come to me, and I would see that he gets justice." And also, whenever anyone approached him to bow down before him, Absalom would reach out his hand, take hold of him, and kiss him. And Absalom behaved in this way toward all the Israelites who came to the king asking for justice, and so he stole the heart of the men of Israel. So Absalom gets his men, he gets up early, goes and stands by the gate. Whenever anybody comes with a complaint, what does he say? "If I were deciding this, I'd be on your side." And when we watch politics, how does it go? Whoever's the other side, what do? They just say, if only I were the one deciding, and they make all of these promises, then this, I would be on your side. I would do what you want. I would help you out. I would be, doesn't even hear what the case is, but I'm on your side. I would decide for you. And we see the politics of that. And then he would shake their hand, and it says here he kisses them. For us, it says he kissed their babies, right? And try to build those relationships. And so we see that in Absalom, that smart kind of political plotting to capture the hearts of the people, and how easy it is. If David sided against them, say, "Oh, I'm so sorry he didn't see it your way. If it was up to me, I'd be on your side." And it's real easy to promise that when you're not the one making the decision, isn't it? It's real easy to promise that when you're not the one in control that actually has the say. And so we see that, and we see that plotting, and he begins again, and since this is football weekend, our first one, who's the most popular player on any football team? It's the second string quarterback. Not the first string quarterback. It's the second team. See, because we convince ourselves, oh, he would do better than who we got. And that's the same way it is, in the political world. The person who's not in control, they would do a better job. They can promise you everything if only they were in control. And so that we see Absalom masterfully playing that political game and building support for himself against his dad. All right, any questions about that first part? Isn't that such a picture of what that life is still like for us? Verse 7. And at the end of 4 years, so he does this for 4 years. At the end of 4 years, Absalom said to the king, "Let me go to Hebron and fulfill a vow I made to the Lord. And while your servant was living in Geshur in Aram, I made this vow. And if the Lord takes me back to Jerusalem, I will worship the Lord in Hebron." And the king said to him, "Go in peace." So he went to Hebron. And then Absalom sent secret messengers throughout the tribes of Israel, saying, "As soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then say, Absalom is king in Hebron." And 200 men from Jerusalem had accompanied Absalom, and they had been invited as guests and went quite innocently, knowing nothing about the matter. And when Absalom was offering sacrifices, he also sent for Ahithophel, the Gilonite, David's counselor, to come to Gihon, his hometown. And so the conspiracy gained strength, and Absalom's followers kept on increasing. And so now he plots out the beginning of his rebellion. And he does it with inviting these 200 people to go with him, but he doesn't tell them what he's doing. And so they end up caught in a mess because he gets there and he's declared king and they're already with him. And so now it's hard for them to go back to Jerusalem. They're standing there before Absalom and all these men. And they also know that word's going to get back to David. They're there with Absalom and they've declared him king. And so they're kind of called almost as if they're forced to be on his side. And so he begins rebellion in the city of Hebron. And he stirs up the trouble from all these places, all this networking that he's been building by telling and making all these promises to everybody and now declaring himself to be king. And one of the people that he kind of got caught and roped into this is Ahithophel, who was one of David's closest friends and closest counselors. All right, verse 13. And a messenger came and told David, "The hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom." And then David said to all his officials, "Who are with him in Jerusalem? Come, we must flee, or none of us will escape from Absalom. And we must leave immediately, or he will move quickly to overtake us and bring ruin on us and put the city to the sword." And the king's officials answered him, "Your servants are ready to do whatever our lord the king chooses." And the king set out with his entire household following him, but he left 10 concubines to take care of the palace. And so the king set out with all the people following him, and they halted at a place some distance away. And all the men marched past him along with the Kerethites and the Pelethites and 600 Gittites, who had accompanied him from Gath, marching before the king. The king said to Atiah the Gittite, "Why should you come along with us? Go back and stay with King Absalom. You are a foreigner, an exile from your homeland. You came only yesterday, and today shall I make you wander about with us? And when I do not know where I'm going, go back and take your countrymen. My kindness and faithfulness will be with you." But Atiah replied to the king, "As surely as the Lord lives and as my lord the king lives, whenever my lord the king may be, wherever it means life or death, you're there your servant will be." And so David learns of this rebellion and he decides that he doesn't want to end up in an open civil war. He doesn't want to fight against his son. So his decision is to avoid the confrontation. And again, how often do we do that? And sometimes that's the right decision, but sometimes it's the wrong decision. I was actually talking with someone today about maturing as a pastor and growing and learning and some of the things that I've learned over all of these years. And one of the things that I struggled with, especially early on, was confrontation. And I still struggle with it. Nobody likes to confront anybody about anything. But there's a verse in Song of Solomon, Neil, that says, kill the foxes while they're little before they get in the hen house. And what the lesson is, and this is something I try to teach my students, is sometimes the right question is, if I don't do anything, what's going to happen? And if nothing's going to change, then not doing anything, you have to weigh whether that's okay or not. But the problem is, if you don't do anything, often the foxes are going to grow up. And it's okay when they're little, but once they get big, they're a much more difficult thing to deal with. And there are a lot of problems that are that way, that if you just ignore them, they just keep growing and growing and growing. And if you would have, as Barney Fife used to say, if you would have nipped it in the bud, it wouldn't have been such a big issue. But when you let it keep growing, then it becomes a bigger problem. And so the wisdom to know when to do that. And so here David, he had several opportunities to deal with Absalom. But his behavior and his confrontation, lack of confrontation, lack of discipline, and now even lack of presence of allowing him to have that relationship with him, just fed and fed and fed until now it's grown up to this open rebellion. And then, even then, instead of confronting, he was in Jerusalem. You heard all the people David had with him. And yet, in fear, and I understand, not wanting to cause a civil war, not wanting to cause a church split, not wanting to cause whatever problem it is, but the fact that he just retreated wide away and flees to avoid that confrontation. And then we see this Gittite captain, Itai, who was there with 600 soldiers, joins David, and David urges him just to return and to stay, but he vows to support David at whatever the cost. And so David welcomes him into the group. And then look at verse 23. And the whole countryside wept aloud. All the people passed by, and the king was crossed the creek Kidron Valley, and all the people moved on toward the desert. And Zadok was there too, and all the Levites who were with him were carrying the Ark of the Covenant of God. And they set down the Ark of the Covenant, and Abiathar offered sacrifice until all the people had finished leaving the city. And then the king said to Zadok, take the Ark of the God back into the city. If I found favor in the Lord's eyes, he will bring me back and let me see it and his dwelling place again. But if he says, I'm not pleased with you, then I'm ready. Let him do to me whatever seems good to him. And so he had the opportunity. They were ready to take the Ark of the Covenant with him when he went. But David left it in the city saying, I don't want to make God a part of this squabble within my family. And so he worships, but then he leaves the ark in the city. Verse 27, the king also said to Zadok the priest, aren't you a seer? Go back to the city in peace, and you and your son Ahimaaz and Jonathan son of Abiathar, you and Abiathar take your two sons with you, and I will wait at the fords of the desert until word comes from you to inform me. So Zadok and Abiathar took the Ark of God back into Jerusalem and stayed there. But David continued up the Mount of Olives, weeping as he went, and his head was covered, and he was barefoot. And all the people with him covered their heads too and were weeping as they went. Now David had been told Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. So David prayed, "O Lord, turn Ahithophel's counsel into foolishness." And when David arrived at the summit where the people used to worship God, Hushai the Archite was there to meet him, and his robe torn and dust on his head. And David said to him, "If you go with me, you will be a burden to me. But if you return to the city and say to Absalom, 'I will be your servant, O king. I was your father's servant in the past, but now I will be your servant,' then you can help me by frustrating Ahithophel's advice. Won't the priest Zadok and Abiathar be there with you? Tell them anything you hear in the king's palace." And their two sons, Ahimaaz, son of Zadok, and Jonathan, son of Abiathar, are there with them. And send them to me with anything you hear. And so David's friend Hushai arrived at Jerusalem as Absalom was entering the city. And so we see his instructions to the priests, Zadok and Abiathar, his covenant, returning the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem and letting them send word to him about what is going on in Jerusalem. And then we see again another faithful friend named Hushai who waited for David on the Mount of Olives but returned to Jerusalem and offered to be an advisor to Absalom, pretending that he had turned back to David just so he could offer bad advice to Absalom. And so we see this difficulty that David has. And think about it. You know, here he was promised to be king. He's been king. He's been king for a number of years now, long enough for Absalom to grow up and then all of this story. And now that he's here, and yet his own son rebels against him and who he considers one of his best friends rebels against him, and just the hurt and the pain and the difficulty, the confrontation of how to deal with all of this. And as I was reading this, I thought again of the psalm that David wrote because of this experience. And so once again, just like we did last time, I want us to flip over to Psalm chapter 3. This is one of the simple psalms of David, but it's one of my favorite psalms and some of my favorite pictures of God that we see in some of David's writings. And it happened right here, chapter 15. This is where David writes this psalm. So Psalm 3. And if you see this, the superscription that's put there, it says for a psalm of David when he fled from his son Absalom. David's the king, but he's the one fleeing Jerusalem. David's the king, but he goes to bed at night and wakes up and finds out that his best friend is there with his son who's rebelled against him, and all of these other people who are following Absalom. And so he flees Jerusalem, and then we didn't read that part, but he's about to get cursed by a guy named Shimei. And so we see David and all of the things that he's dealing with, and the way he says it here at the beginning, I always think of it's like you go to bed with a lot of problems, you can't sleep. And you toss and turn all night, and you wake up in the morning to find out it's just gotten worse. And if you've ever been there, that's kind of what David has gone. He's overwhelmed by the disloyalty of the people, and even you're going to hear how the people are accusing him that God has deserted him. And so listen to the words of David. "O Lord, how many are my foes? How many rise up against me? Many are saying to me, 'God will not deliver him.'" Now, there's trouble everywhere. Absalom has rebelled. The people have been disloyal. And here is the rumor that's going around. David's in such bad shape, even God can't save him. or even God won't save him. And guys, you hear all the time people say, God won't put anything on you that's more than you can handle. That's not in the Bible anywhere. Matter of fact, there are lots of times he puts on us more than we can handle, and that's the whole point, because it's for us to realize we can't do it, and so we need him to rescue us. And that's where David was. He went to bed at night with everybody against him, woke up and found even some of the people he was counting on had turned their backs on him. And so everywhere he looked, all he found was trouble, so bad that many were saying of me, God will not deliver him. And then verse 3. But you are a shield around me, O Lord. You bestow glory on me, and you lift up my head. To the Lord I cry aloud, and he answers me from his holy hill. He says, you are a shield to protect me. All these people are against me, but God is there to protect me. Just like Paul said, if God is on our side, you know, what does it matter who's against us? David knew that God was with him. And you look down in verse 6 and it says, I will not fear the tens of thousands that are drawn up on every side. Tens of thousands of people were against him. His best friends had deserted him. But he said, God, you're a shield to defend me, to protect me. And this is the word for shield, which was it's the word that's used when you were in a chariot and you had a shield bearer, and that shield would be taller than you were, and they would hold it and so that nothing could get around to hit you. And he says that's what you are, God. Even though there are 10,000 of them against me, you're going to protect me. And so I remember Martin Luther when he was at the Diet of Worms, where he was being attacked for his faith statements. His friend Spalton wrote him a message and told him not to come. If he did, a mob would rise up to kill him. And Luther's response was this, and I quote, "Go tell your master that even should there be as many devils and worms as tiles on the housetops, I will still enter." And that's where he went on to say, here I will stand. And it's because of that commitment that he knew God was with him. And that's what David, no matter how many are against me, God is with me. But look at what all he promises there. Verse 3, he's a shield around us. He will bestow glory on me. He will restore my honor. And this is what we need to remember, that the only honor that matters is the honor that God places on us. It's not the praise of men. That's fickle. That's what Absalom had courted. What we need to worry about is the honor that only comes from God, that God recognizes our service, that God says, well done, my good and faithful servant. That only the only real glory or honor that counts comes from God. And so he says, you bestow glory on me. You honor me. That's where my encouragement comes from. And then he says this neat phrase, and you lift up my head. And it's a picture of God coming to encourage us. And I usually illustrate this way. I remember there have been some times in my life when I've been real discouraged. And I remember specifically a time early in my ministry. And I had just come home all distraught and discouraged. And I was sitting in my recliner. And Darlena came into the room. and my head's down on my chest like this. And she took her finger and she put it under my chin and she lifted up my head so that I had to look her straight in the eye. And she said, "It's going to be okay, baby. God's got this." Those were her exact words. But hear this picture of David. What does he say? God lifted up my head. When our head is downcast, when we're discouraged, it's God who lifts up our head. So we have to look at His face. What does the old hymn say? When we look at His face, all the things of this world come strangely dim. Yep. And so He lifts up our head. And then, look at verse 4. Not only does He restore our honor, not only does He lift up our head, but He goes on then to say, "To the Lord I cry aloud, and He answers me." And so no matter how bad it may get, when I cry out to God, He hears me and He answers me. He not only hears us, but He answers and responds. Now that doesn't mean He always does what we want Him to do. That's not how prayer works. But He always hears and knows. He already knows our heart and our pain. And that's why even in the New Testament said, even when we're so distraught that we can't verbalize what we need, what does it say? The Holy Spirit moans and groans for us. God hears us and answers us. And then the most important part of that, He hears and He answers me from His holy hill. David just fled Jerusalem. Where's the holy hill? In Jerusalem. And so he's saying, I may not be the king anymore. I may have had to flee the city, but God is still on His throne, on His holy hill. He's still the one who's in control. Absalom's not in control. God is. God is. And because of that, as the old hymn says, because He lives, I can face tomorrow. Because He lives, all fear is gone. I know, yes, I know, yes, I know, life is worth the living. Just because He lives. So we see God's protection in these tough times. And then we see God's peace of mind over the trouble. Look at what He says in verse 5. I lie down and sleep, and I wake again because the Lord sustains me. I will not fear the tens of thousands drawn up on me on every side. He says, I can sleep at night because God is with me. And he talks about it again in the next Psalm, Psalm 4. But look at verse 8 of Psalm 4 real quick. He says, I will lie down and sleep in peace, for You are alone. O Lord, make me dwell in safety. And so, again, that idea that no matter how bad things are, we can still lay down and go to sleep at night. Why? Because we trust God's the one that control. Remember the last time when he was so restless, he woke up and found it had gotten worse. But he knows now, I can, because God is with me, I can lay down at night because I trust Him. There's a sign, one of Darlene's little signs in our bedroom that says, give it all to God. And because He's going to be up all night anyways. And so that same idea that we can trust it with Him, and even while we sleep, and while we sleep in peace, because we know He's the one that's in control. And then verse 7 and 8. Arise, O Lord, deliver me, O my God. Strike all my enemies on the jaw. Break the teeth of the wicked. For from the Lord comes deliverance. May Your blessing be on Your people. Now, I guess, again, football week, this isn't a bad thing to say, because he says here, he ends with, God, just punch him in the mouth for me. And again, we see the honestness of David's prayer. He's hurting, and he wants God to get them. And the fact that he says punch him in the mouth, I think it's because it was what was coming out of their mouth is what was hurting him the most. You know, it was their cutting words that had been hurting David. And I think he just wants them to shut them up and make the, everybody see that these accusations that Absalom had been making against him weren't true. And instead, may God bring blessing on his people. May he deliver us. And so pray for God to bless his people. So, trouble everywhere. You might not be run out of town. You may just think they're going to run you out of town. But God is there. He is the shield around you. He restores your glory. He lifts your head. And he will answer from his holy hill.